Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, a nationwide Bucknell University poll finds that most Americans support voter ID laws and want term limits on Supreme Court justices. But up front, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the most famous and by far the most quoted line in the Declaration of Independence. But what about the rest of the document that is not only iconic here in the United States, but throughout the world? As we approach the Independence Day holiday this weekend, what did the Declaration of Independence, dated July 4th, 1776, actually say and mean? Joining us today is Randy E. Barnett, the Patrick Ho Tung Professor of Constitutional Law and Director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitutional Law, for the Constitution at Georgetown Law. He's the author of 12 books, including his latest, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Professor Barnett, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me here. Today is Independence Day, July 2nd. Does everybody know why July 2nd is Independence Day?
Actually, wasn't that because that's when Jefferson and the other authors of the Declaration presented it to the Continental Congress?
Well, it's close. It's because this is when the Continental Congress approved the resolution declaring their independence, that saying that these United States are and of right ought to be free and independent states, and that they are absolved from all allegiance to the crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. They voted for that today on July 2nd. John Adams thought today was going to be celebrated as Independence Day, but he was wrong. In fact, it was July 4th when the Congress then adopted the Declaration of Independence, which justified the decision that they had voted on 2 days earlier.
Ah, okay. See, right off the bat, we've learned something today. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I started with the line about we hold these truths to be self-evident. Why does that line in the Declaration get quoted so often?
Well, because it states the first proposition of what came to be and what was officially adopted as the American theory of government. And the American theory of government can be summarized in one sentence, and that is, first come rights and then comes government. And that sentence that you just quoted, the most famous sentence, is about the first come rights part of the theory. And then the next sentence, which generally does not get quoted, is about the then comes government part of our theory. So the next sentence begins, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So the first sentence you read is the affirmation of first come rights. And the second sentence that follows it is an affirmation that then and only then comes government.
But, you know, and I'm kind of going to go chronologically with this, but when talking about that line, especially over the last year when the nation has had this racial reckoning, that line has been quoted most often, and you often hear people say it's ironic because it's written by and represented a would-be nation where all men and women were not created equal, and there were millions that were enslaved. Was there any irony by those who wrote the Declaration about that line, considering that slavery was such a part of the country at that point?
I would say not at all. The American people were divided on the subject of slavery, but the Declaration was the opening salvo of what became eventually the emancipation movement to free American slaves. It's remarkable that on the day the Declaration was issued, all 13 colonies, then becoming states, had legally recognized slavery. And just 11 years later, when the Constitution gets proposed, in 1787, half the states have now moved towards abolishing slavery. And one of those, Massachusetts, did so on the basis of language that was very similar to what was in the Declaration and had been put in its state constitution. In fact, it was language that Jefferson was borrowing from when he wrote the Declaration. That was the language of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court declared that slavery was unconstitutional in Massachusetts on the basis of that language. Even after the adoption of the Constitution, the anti-slavery movement continued to grow in the United States until finally it so threatened Southern interests that the South was prepared to secede from the Union to stop its continued advance.
And from what I understand, as you have written and said, is that afterwards, that years afterwards, that the Southern states were ready to just discard the Declaration of Independence because of that line.
Absolutely. One such person referred to the Declaration, that sentence in the Declaration, as a farrago of nonsense. It wasn't that the Declaration was compatible with slavery, it's that the Declaration had to be repudiated because it was so clearly incompatible with slavery.
So one of the things that you've also written is that the Declaration of Independence was a legal document. It wasn't just a group of disgruntled colonists saying, well, you made us mad, so we're going off on our own. Why is that distinction important, that this was a legal document?
Yeah, it was. First of all, it's the officially adopted position of the United States of America on its founding day. This is when the United States was founded. It was not founded in 1619. It was founded either on July 2nd or on July 4th. You can take your pick. That's when the United States was beginning. And this was the officially adopted theory of what government should be and why the colonists, now declaring their independence, were entitled to resist another polity, the polity of Great Britain, by force of arms if necessary. So what this document represented was their defense, because, of course, the British considered them to be traitors, insurrectionists, as you will, who were susceptible to being hanged should they be captured. In fact, one of the lines that was attributed to the period said that if we do not all hang together, then surely we will hang separately. Because that is what they were facing. But this is their public announcement, they said, to a candid world as to what justified the move that they made. And it's interesting to see what it was they did think justified the move that they made.
So in the colonists' eyes, this was a legal document. What about in Great Britain? How did King George III see this, and how did Parliament and other British subjects see this?
Well, as to be expected, they thought that the Americans were insurrectionists and they thought the Americans were traitors. They didn't accept this justification. The justification wasn't written for the benefit of those from whom they were separating. It was written for the benefit of a candid world. It was written for the benefit of third parties who were going to witness this fight and decide who was right. And so this is the colonists, now free Americans, statement about why their actions were justified. And they weren't justified just because rights were violated. They were justified because of what the Declaration referred to as a long train of abuses. What this tells us is that the violation of rights that they did not think was enough to justify a revolution. That governments violate rights all the time, and they knew that. What it had to be was such a long train of abuses that it amounted to nothing like a criminal conspiracy against the rights of the Americans. And that's the reason why, after the first two famous paragraphs, there's a bill of particulars that follow that detail all of the different types of rights that had been violated, all the different kinds of abuses of power, not just violations of rights, that the British had committed against the American people.
How many are listed in the Declaration?
How many of those abuses?
Yeah.
I have not done a count on how many. One that was omitted because of objections of Southern states, some Southern states, was the fact that the Great Britain had imposed slavery on the United States. and were responsible for that institution. That was something Jefferson wrote, but was ultimately objected to when the body as a whole came to consider it. And that's another point to be made here. And that is that some today dismiss the Declaration on the grounds that it was just Jefferson. And Jefferson was kind of a wide-eyed radical. And then by the time the Constitution gets adopted, sort of clearer heads had prevailed, and it was time to govern and set aside the principles of the Declaration. But in fact, the Declaration, though the first draft was authored by Jefferson, it was edited by the committee that he served on, and it was voted on, and in sometimes it was objected to by the different delegates to the Congress of the United States. And so once again, I want to stress, this was the officially adopted political theory of the United States on the day it was founded.
The Declaration, you touched on this, the Declaration was divided into several parts: a preamble, or the assertion of individual rights, a list of grievances, and then a formal Declaration of Independence. You know, it seems so simple today, but that division, those divisions there, that was important in how this document was laid out, wasn't it?
Yes, this is very much like an indictment. I used to be a criminal prosecutor in Chicago, and we would prosecute people. But before we could prosecute them, we had to obtain either an information or an indictment. An indictment was issued by a grand jury, and an information was issued by a judge. And what those documents consisted of, what they did, is they provided the legal basis for the prosecution of a defendant. For in this case, this is what would have to be done to prosecute for a felony. In the case of a misdemeanor, you have to file a complaint. This is a publicly accessible justification for why this individual is being singled out for criminal prosecution. That's what the Declaration was. It was a bill of indictment against the government of Great Britain to justify the actions they were about to take using force, using coercion. Just as we do in the criminal justice system. Their actions were to be measured and justified on the basis of the truth or falsity of the claims they made in the Declaration.
We're going to talk about some of the specific language in the Declaration of Independence and what it means in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest during this portion of the program is Randy E. Barnett, the Patrick Ho Tung Professor of Constitutional Law and Director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution at Georgetown Law. He's the author of 12 books, including his latest, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. We'll talk about the book in just a few minutes. But if you have a question or comment as we're talking about the Declaration of Independence going into what is now recognized as Independence Day on July 4th, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so, Professor, I want to go down through some of the language in the Declaration and have you discuss what Jefferson and the other adopters were saying. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. All right, so what are they saying there?
This is a wonderful affirmation of natural rights and social compact theory. In other words, this is an affirmation of the fact that the social compact, which then existed between the American people as one people, because it says one people, as one people, the connection between the American people and Great Britain, the social compact that had existed is now dissolved. It is now dissolved. There is no law. And what that means is, according to natural rights, social compact theory, is the American people no longer recognize one power that governs both of those polities, just the way that we are in a state of nature relative to other countries, that we don't have a common government over us. The American people now are resuming their rightful station as equals in the state of nature vis-a-vis the British government. And And they invoke the law of nature and nature's God. This language sometimes is used to suggest that natural rights were thought to be strictly divine rights, rights that came from God. Well, they were thought to have come from God, but only indirectly. That is, God creates an orderly world, and then the order of the world dictates what rights we have. And so we have those rights because the world is an orderly place. We need those rights to accomplish our ends, which is the pursuit of happiness in society with others. And that order is there either because God created it or it got there some other way, but the order is there nevertheless, and those rights are there nevertheless.
Okay, so we did talk about that we hold these truths to be self-evident, and the rights, pursuit of happiness, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And you mentioned this earlier.
Let me just say a word about that. Each one of those are individual rights. They are not the rights of a collective. They are not the rights of a group. They are individual rights. It is the individual who has a right to life. It is the individual who has a right to liberty, and the individual who has a right to pursue happiness. Not to achieve happiness. There's no guarantee of happiness, but to pursue happiness. So each one of those, I need to stress, is an individual right. Some today would question whether individual rights are a good thing or a bad thing in favor of more group rights. And I see this coming from the right as well as from the left. But the founders believed in individual rights, and these were the ones, this is how they summarize it in this particular statement.
Well, and you could make the case that that's one of the things that sets the United States apart, is that recognition of individual rights. Let's go to the next line, and you did touch on this, but I want to talk about a little bit more, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. What does that mean?
Right. Well, the first part of that sentence talks about the American theory of government, which is that government is there. What is the purpose of government? It states what the purpose of government is. The purpose of government is to secure these rights. Which rights? The pre-existing, natural, unalienable, and individual rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness mentioned in the previous sentence. That states the purpose of government. And then it goes on, that sentence then goes on to say, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. This is a sentence that many people focus on. They overlook the first part of that sentence, the security to secure these rights, focus on the second part of the sentence, because it seems to suggest that the consent of the governed is really what should be operate, is really the theory of our government, the consent of the government. And then that leads them to say, well, that must be a majority consent because you can't have unanimous consent. And so majority should rule. And that means the majorities in legislature should rule. All of that seems to follow from the consent of the governed. And that includes even the power of the majority to violate our rights. But I think that's a misreading of the sentence. The relationship of the first to the second part of the sentence is the first part reaffirms the individual natural rights are the end of government. And the second part is really about which government is to govern us, the government of Great Britain or the government of the United States. This is a statement that the people get to choose which government governs, but it isn't about majoritarian will being imposed on a dissenting minority.
With this next sentence, you can see that the tone of the document is changing now, that we're going from establishing rights that man has and government's role in that. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. What are they saying there?
Yes, that this goes back to what I said before the break, and that is that individual rights violations are not just sufficient to justify a revolution. What this is saying is a long train of abuses pursuing invariably the same object, and that this is evidence of what they call a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. Essentially, what they're saying is the pattern of behavior evinces a conspiracy against an ongoing conspiracy against the rights of the individual in the United States, and that's what justifies revolution.
So then we go on to the next line. Maybe not the next line. In the next line here is, as we're laying it out, such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. This sounds like that indictment you were talking about.
Yes, and the next sentence says, to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. That is to the third parties who are going to be witnessing this. Now, the Americans were actually very slow in concluding that the King of Great Britain, George III, was actually to be at fault here. For many, many years, they pursued a theory that it was Parliament that was unjustly ruling the American colonies, and the king was not to be blamed. That actually they wanted to live under the ruling of the king, much like Canada lives under the ruling of the queen, but they just wanted their own Parliament, and they thought Parliament had no authority over them. It was only after repeated applications to the king were turned away, did they finally conclude that no, the king is in on this as well, and therefore revolution is now justified.
So, you know, I'm going to stop with quoting the document and kind of sum up here. If you were, I mean, you touched on this earlier, describe it. I mean, this was, I used the word revolutionary, but no pun intended. At the time, it was revolutionary, and it was unique, and it is something that had a long life that led to other documents that we'll talk about in just a few minutes. But, I mean, are all those things accurate, right?
Absolutely. It was a signal event in the history of humankind that came to be emulated in other places of the world. And as we have talked about at the top of the hour, and I guess we'll get back to now, it continued to resonate through the American political system when the American political system itself was found to be incompatible with its principles.
You know, something you said very early on that I think that many Americans kind of take for granted because this happened 245 years ago. But the men who signed the Declaration of Independence, if they would have been captured, they would have been executed as traitors, or at the very least imprisoned as traitors. I mean, they were considered radicals by the British, correct?
Yes. And think about this. I mean, one of the things we hear said about these individuals is that they were all property wealthy people. And they generally were property wealthy people as compared to the rest of Americans at that time. And yet they were willing to put at risk their property and their wealth on this gamble towards independence. They had more to lose than anybody else in the colonies, because they were so wealthy and compared to others. And yet they felt that this was necessary on the basis of what can only be described as first principles.
After the Declaration of Independence was adopted, there would be readings of the Declaration throughout the colonies. Just here locally, there are several places here in central Pennsylvania where you can see markers that say the Declaration of Independence was read here on July 6, 1776. So how was it accepted in the colonies by the American colonists at the time?
It was obviously a big event. It was, as you say, widely read, widely appreciated. It was, you know, rather poetic in its formulation of language. It was not necessarily the canonical statement of natural rights. That actually was George Mason's Declaration of Rights that he authored for the Virginia Declaration of Rights, and he wrote it 2 weeks before Jefferson wrote the Declaration, and Jefferson had his draft, Mason's draft, in front of him when he wrote the Declaration. And it was that formulation, it was Mason's formulation, that got put into four other state constitutions, and I said earlier, was used in Massachusetts to abolish slavery by judicial decree. But the Declaration, because it was so poetic, It became a foundation stone. And once again, I want to stress, it became a foundation stone of those who were urging the emancipation of all African-Americans who were then enslaved, not just the ones that were being emancipated in the North. But it was used in the North to justify emancipation there and ultimately to justify an anti-slavery movement that led to the formation of the anti-slavery Republican Party, which the election of which drove the South out of the Union.
The Declaration was the grounds for the Constitution. In what way?
Because it set up, it declared separation, it established us as a nation, and then it said what the purpose of government was, but it didn't actually specify what government we would then have. There were then two cracks at government, and I somewhat might say there had been three. The first one was the Articles of Confederation that was initially adopted. This proved to be unsatisfactory to a critical mass of influential people, and they eventually culminated in a convention in Philadelphia to draft a replacement, which we know as the Constitution of the United States. So that was the Constitution was our second crack at implementing the principles of the Declaration. And then I think a case can be made that our form of government was substantially altered by the adoption of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments in the wake of the Civil War, which changed the relationship of the people, especially to their own state governments, in ways that were not reflected in the original Constitution and constitute, in some sense, a third crack at government, the first one having eventually culminated in a Civil War. The second one culminating in a Civil War.
You know, we've often heard that Abraham Lincoln, I don't know whether idolized is the word, but held the Declaration of Independence in great esteem, and that the Gettysburg Address was influenced by the Declaration of Independence, or Lincoln was thinking about that. In what ways?
Yeah, Lincoln often discussed the Declaration of Independence. He called it the apple of gold, around which the Constitution was a picture frame. And so the apple of gold was the Declaration. The Constitution was the frame around the apple of gold. And Lincoln, in this regard, was simply repeating what had become a standard conception, a standard theory of the anti-slavery movement, which was a very powerful movement, which, as I say, ultimately led to the formation of the Republican Party after failed attempts at the Liberty Party, the Free Soil Party. The Republican Party finally succeeds. And what Lincoln is enunciating is what was pretty standard anti-slavery constitutionalist thinking about the relationship between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. The Declaration was the apple of gold, and the Constitution was the frame of silver that surrounded that apple.
Professor Barnett, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You are a prolific writer. You've authored a dozen books now. Your latest book, Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Right. Well, much of what we've talked about today is in one of the chapters of that book. All of what we've talked about today is in that book. In that book, I talk about what We the People really signifies, and does it signify We the People as a group, which therefore the majority or the will of We the People should prevail, or does it signify We the People as individuals, each one of whom has individual rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that the government must protect? And a Republican form of government is necessary to protect the rights of each of us, as opposed to simply reflect the will of the majority. That's what Republican government, I think, became once the Constitution was adopted in the form that we have it.
And, you know, today there would be some people who would say our Republican Constitution may read that as a political meaning Republican Party, and that's not what you're talking about.
No, Republican in the sense that it is something that we have popular sovereignty in this country that's based on we the people, as opposed to parliamentary sovereignty based on the will of a parliament or a Congress. It's a Republican government. The question is, what does Republican government mean? Majoritarian government or the protection of the rights of we the people, each and every one of us? The Declaration stands for the latter proposition.
Why the need for this book now?
Because the Constitution has been coming under sustained attack from the left and also at times from the right for being anti-democratic or undemocratic or not democratic enough. But what these critics usually mean by democratic is majoritarian, that somehow the will of the majority should prevail no matter what. And a Republican constitution needs to be understood as something other than reflecting the will of the majority. Republican constitution is the means by which the rights of all of us are secured. And that's the rights of each and every one of us. Now, democratic elections play a role in that as a check on government power, an essential role. But democratic elections need to be justified. They don't justify themselves. And a book like this was meant to explain why our Constitution is undemocratic to the extent it is undemocratic and why that's not a bad thing. That's actually a good thing. And we discard that thing at our peril.
Randy E. Barnett, the Patrick Ho Tung Professor of Constitutional Law and Director of the Georgetown Center for the Constitution at Georgetown Law. His latest book is Our Republican Constitution, Securing the Liberty and Sovereignty of We the People. Professor Barnett, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure, and happy Independence Day.
And happy Independence Day to you. I'm not going to say happy 4th of July. Happy Independence Day. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Before we get into our next segment, just got an email from Brad, who just wanted to follow up on our conversation with Professor Burnett. He says, I find it interesting that George Mason's writings influenced Massachusetts to abolish slavery. Yet his own state of Virginia kept the institution for many years. Something to think about there. By the way, coming up on Monday's program, actually there is not a Smart Talk program on Monday. There will be The Pulse at 9 a.m. exploring Mars and when we could expect to actually see humans set foot on the planet. The Bucknell Institute for Public Policy published a new survey that indicates there is a substantial support among Americans for universal voter ID laws and Supreme Court term limits. However, the survey also found that fundamental changes to the way elections are run in the U.S. were either unpopular overall or supported only along party lines. We're joined by Dr. Chris Ellis, professor of political science and co-director of the Bucknell Institute for Public Policy, to discuss this poll. Dr. Ellis, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so let's talk about voter ID laws. Your poll showed support for voters showing identification every time they vote. How much support?
So what we found, and we tried to ask this in the simplest way possible, because obviously the way that you ask this kind of question is going to lead to different responses. So we just asked whether people would support or oppose requiring all citizens to show a valid ID in order to vote. So people can interpret that in different ways, but I thought it was straightforward. We're finding about 65-70% of Americans with an opinion on this issue support something like voter ID laws. And the thing that I think was interesting about this is we asked about 15 different questions on different kinds of reforms of the political system. This was one of the very few that got both bipartisan support and support across different lines of race and ethnicity, across different generational lines, across gender lines. And so we're finding, I mean, again, Republicans are predictably more supportive of this than Democrats are, but we're finding that this is one of the few aspects of the political system that could be changed that we think has at least something like bipartisan support and support across all sorts of different groups that might be affected by it.
Do you, as we're analyzing these results, do you have a theory on why Americans support voter ID?
Yeah, I mean, and it is just a theory, but I think, you know, in looking at some of our other questions, Americans are also, I think, very supportive of expanded access to the vote, whether it's early voting or whether it's absentee voting without an excuse and things like that. So I think there's two things going on. One, I think Americans want elections to be more open. And we see that in a bunch of different ways, right? So if anyone wants to vote, they can. But I think there's also maybe it's not a concern about fraud. I know that's sort of like on the far right, there's some concerns about, you know, voter fraud, which again, we know is sort of fairly rare, but a concern that elections are secure. And if voter ID is one of the things that helps secure elections to make us confident in the results, and I think people are supportive of that too.
And as you mentioned, I just would like you to talk a little bit more about this, that the support for voter ID crossed all demographics, all racial lines. I mean, it had widespread support. I guess if you could say the one area where it didn't have widespread support was amongst Democrats.
Among Democrats, we still got majority support. The only place we didn't find widespread support for voter ID was among a subset of Democrats, college-educated white people. And so basically how we define them is people who call themselves Democrats, who identify as white, and also have a BA degree or higher. That is the only place where we did not see support for voter ID laws.
So, and, you know, just a few weeks ago, I talked with your colleagues at Franklin Marshall College who had similar results. Actually, I think theirs was even higher for support for voter ID. This has to be a surprise in some way. I mean, just this week, Governor Tom Wolf vetoed a law because, and he pointed to voter ID as being part of it. Those who oppose voter ID laws say that it is meant to suppress some voters, that it is difficult for, or at least a challenge for some voters to be able to have the ID or have access, that kind of thing. So having that much support amongst the American people, and this is a nationwide poll, by the way, I mean, there has to be like some kind of a surprise there, doesn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple things happening here. One, I think voter ID has become, at least among people who talk about this a lot, and remember, keep in mind, most Americans don't really think about this all that often.
That's right.
I think you're right. I think it's become politicized, at least in part, because a voter ID requirement has been attached to bills, you know, both in Pennsylvania and other places, has been attached to bills that require, that also have a lot of other, you know, frankly, fairly onerous voter suppression kinds of things, or at least things that make it harder to make it vote, to make people vote. And I think that that's part of what's happening here. It's not voter ID as in people just show up with an ID, they can get it from the government, they can get it free. You know, Joe Manchin's bill said it could, in its proposed bill in Congress said it could be something as simple as a utility bill. It's not as, it's become sort of part of this smorgasbord of kind of making it harder to vote regulation. So I think that's why it's become politicized. But if you talk to regular people who don't, you know, think about the integrity of elections very much, I think they sort of see this as sort of a common sense measure to make sure things are secure. And if it could be decoupled from, I think, a lot of this other stuff that sort of would make it harder for people to vote, then maybe that would go away. But in the current political environment, I'm not sure that's happening.
Yeah, I had the feeling that if you ask most regular people, as you call them, and I often refer to them that way, that they think of this as, I show an ID for so many other things, what's the difference with showing it with voting? But again, most people don't think about the other things that are involved with it. I want to switch gears for just a moment. You ask a question about Supreme Court justices and whether there should be term limits on Supreme Court justices. This is kind of a unique question in polls. And in fact, I don't know whether I've seen that question asking polls. Why did you ask that question?
We were, because of all of the, you know, discussion about, you know, what's going on with the Supreme Court, a 6-3 conservative majority, some, you know, agitation by, you know, by Democrats about wanting to expand it or at least change what the courts do. We just wanted to ask a wide range of things. Some of them, frankly, maybe unconstitutional, some of them not, but to get a sense of what the public thought the Supreme Court's role was within kind of the broader system of government in the United States. So we asked this, we asked about, you know, again, things that probably couldn't happen given the current state of government. But we asked things about like whether judges should be appointed by a bipartisan panel instead of by the Senate and things like that, whether the court should be expanded. And term limits was one of the things that we found. Again, there's maybe a sliver of an argument where this would be constitutional. It's you know, tough to see. But this was one of the things that I think we saw the public, you know, being reasonably supportive of, thinking that there's you know, maybe a problem with the court, but this would be a way to fix it without politicizing it, without jamming a bunch of justices in right now, but saying that, you know, maybe life tenure is not the best idea for how we should conduct our judiciary in the United States.
So what did the poll show as far as support for term limits? And you actually had a term limit, a specific term limit, as part of the question, didn't you?
Yes, we said 15-year terms. We've seen, I mean, there's national proposals about 15 years. I think the most common one is 18 years, but something along those lines. And we saw, again, that 65% of Americans with an opinion thought this was a good idea. Again, more popular among Democrats, given the current environment and given the current ideological composition of support. 80% of Democrats supported it. But almost half of Republicans supported it as well, right? When we don't see those kinds of things for other kinds of proposals that might make it harder for Republicans to have power. So at least there was something, again, not quite bipartisan, but at least there was something that suggests that maybe if we're thinking about what the judiciary should do, then this would be, you know, if you squint, kind of a way forward to make people happy, knowing that maybe the judiciary would not be insulated by life tenure, but also would not be politicized in the short term, which we found that people didn't like.
You know, I always like to talk about history, and the Supreme Court, I don't know whether I can say that at this point it is politicized as much as it's ever been. But, I mean, we go back to Franklin Roosevelt, who wanted to expand the size of the Supreme Court, often called packing the court. There was some talk of Joe Biden, whether he actually wanted to, you know, there were those encouraging him to do that. But, I mean, and I don't know whether you have a sense of history or not, but the court has become so politicized. You know, maybe not the judges themselves, the justices themselves, but the process itself. President appoints one, a person. Senate, there's a fight. Ever since Robert Bork in the late 80s, it is a huge fight to get a Supreme Court justice approved. I mean, so does that say that the public is more open to some changes here?
I think so. So if we look at history, I mean, the FDR thing was the closest thing I think we've seen, maybe Abraham Lincoln, but the closest thing we've seen to an end run around the Constitution that's ever happened, right? And one of the reasons, and this is going back to the Stone Ages of polling data, so I'm not sure even how reliable this is, but I think one of the reasons FDR didn't do it, it didn't end up packing the court. I mean, partially he got the court to bend to his will, of course. But even back then, that was sort of an unpopular way to get these proposals passed. So, yeah, the court's always been political. It's always been this sort of thing. But if we even go back, you know, 20 or 25 years, we're still looking at a place where there is something like bipartisan, at least deference to the president, right? I mean, Scalia was approved, was confirmed to the court by a unanimous vote in the Senate. I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg got 96 votes, and these were not non-ideological justices, right? So these were people that we knew what they were going to do, but there was at least this kind of sense of the president won the election, they get to appoint a justice, and we go from there. And what we saw, I mean, certainly under Mitch McConnell's rule in the Senate, but we'd see this if Andrew Cuomo became majority leader in you know, under a, you know, whatever, a Ron DeSantis presidency. I think that era is over, and that's what makes this challenging, right? That even in a time when we were trying to confirm ideologically, not extreme, but justices whose positions were ideologically known, there was still at least they're qualified, they know what they're doing, they're going to respect the law, and we go from there. And I don't think we're there anymore. And that, I think, more than anything, might explain the public's frustration with how this process works.
You said that there could be a constitutional question about a term limit. In what way? Why would there be some question about the constitutionality?
So the Constitution has broadly been accepted to say that what the Constitution says is justices can hold their term in times of good behavior. And that has been basically interpreted since the beginning as federal justices have life tenure. Now, that's not universally accepted, of course, and there could be a way to say, you know, we're going to let justices be nominated for an 18-year term or 15-year term, and they get to hold those positions in times of good behavior. So there may be a way around that, but that would require at least some reinterpretation of how the Constitution has been interpreted to say what federal justices can do, right? So life tenure has sort of been, you know, generally accepted for 200 years. It doesn't explicitly say that, so there could be a way to make that not the case, but it would require at least a rethinking of what the Constitution does. Mm-hmm. So to do this without a constitutional amendment would require at least some legal gymnastics.
The poll also showed that the most people opposed increasing the size of the Supreme Court to 13 members. It was 35% support, 40% opposed, low support from independents and Republicans, and that's not surprising. I want to move on to another issue. You know, the last two presidential elections or two recent presidential elections, popular vote winner did not win the Electoral College, both 2000 and 2016. The question of whether the Electoral College should be replaced with a national popular vote system. So what did those who were asked have to say about that?
So this was, again, another proposal that got majority support, but this was very partisan, right? So we found about 60% of Americans with an opinion thought that we should get rid of the Electoral College. Again, challenging to do under the current interpretation of the Constitution, but thought we should do that. 92% of Democrats thought it was the right thing to do, only 16% of Republicans, and about half of independents. And the partisan results here, I mean, obviously make sense given the 2016 election, given people's memories of the 2000 election. And maybe that does sort of make sense given kind of the changing demographics of the country and where votes are packed and things like that. But it was, I mean, I don't want to say concerning to me, but a little frustrating to me that this was sort of such a partisan issue, because the Electoral College historically, I mean, I think now it's pretty clear there's a pro-Republican bias in Electoral College based on composition of states and whatnot. But that hasn't always been the case, right? In fact, for most of the 20th century, the Electoral College, if anything, had a pro-Democratic bias. And if we go back to 2004, I mean, George Bush won Ohio by, I forget the number, but a couple thousand votes. If he had not done that, Bush would have won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College vote. So right now we're seeing a fairly partisan split on this, but the Electoral College has sort of been a liability to both parties over time. And, you know, I'm not going to offer a value judgment on whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. I think, you know, there's people on all sides of the issue, but this is one of those things that's become an extremely partisan issue. Again, because of what you said, just given how things have played out over the past few years, but it's not, I mean, this is the case with all sorts of other reforms to the American political system, getting rid of the filibuster or adding states or adding territories to states, that there's a clear partisan lean or clear partisan advantage now, but that's not necessarily going to be the case going forward. So I think there's a lot of short-term thinking on this kind of stuff.
You ask whether Americans supported Puerto Rico statehood and District of Columbia statehood. What did they say?
So, again, partisan divides on this, but Americans in general are more supportive of Puerto Rico than D.C., which I think I just find funny, and I think probably reflects people's opinions of D.C., but there are certainly a lot more independents that think Puerto Rico should become a U.S. state than Washington, D.C. I mean, the results are not that different, but, you know, if we're thinking about ways to change the political system, this is one thing that's been talked about for a long time. Democrats are agitating for it now, I think, because they think it would allow two more Democratic representatives, two more Democratic senators and whatnot. But again, this is maybe a short-term thing, and I'm not sure, you know, in terms of partisan advantage. I mean, it might be the right thing to do, but I'm not sure we could rely on Puerto Rico to be reliably Democratic going forward just for a lot of different reasons.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know what the breakdown in Puerto Rico was with the 2020 election, but it surprised a lot of people that Donald Trump did as well with Latino voters as he did. I mean, a lot of people thought that Latino voters would vote Democratic, and the majority did, but that in Florida, for example, Texas, for example, Trump had some large Latino vote percentage. Chris Ellis, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Interesting what you found here, some unique questions. Dr. Chris Ellis is professor of political science and co-director of the Bucknell Institute for Public Policy. Always good talking with you, Chris. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great weekend.